of thick biological tissues. It's a theme which is going to recur in Simon Arridge's talk and Amir Ghanavash's talk. And what I would like to do today is really to focus on some of the physical ideas involved and say a bit about the relevant inverse scattering problems. So, with that in mind, what's this going on around here? There we go. Okay. Thank you. Good. So with that in mind, I'll just talk about the sort of biological and clinical motivation for the work and then move into a physical description of scattering and inverse scattering problems with diffuse light and concluding with some issues involving image reconstruction and resolution. Okay, so let's begin with a cartoon. So this is a cartoon, or a schematic, of a simple diffusion tomography system. And there are a couple of relevant components to focus on. First of all, in the middle, we have a mathematical representation of a patient. So this is a scattering medium with some other inclusion inside of it, whose optical properties are different than the surrounding tissue. Then there are a number of other components. There is a laser system. Typically, the laser radiation is brought to the patient by means of optical fibers, taken away by optical fibers to the detectors, and then there is some other stuff which goes on inside of this computer, and of course, that's the part we're really interested in here, because there is, at heart, a very delicate nonlinear inverse problem behind this diffusion tomography business. So what's the rationale for this? So one has to ask, given the rather astonishing ability of MRI and CT to diagnose virtually every imaginable medical condition, why do we need another medical imaging modality? And so this is not in any way a real answer to that question, but it's at least a couple of suggestions. So the first point is that with optical tomography, there are new contrast mechanisms which can be exploited, which are not seen in the other imaging modalities that I mentioned. So in particular, within the near-infrared window of the optical spectrum, namely at about 800 nanometers or so, tissue is relatively transparent, meaning that its absorption is much less than its scattering, and so quite a lot of light can penetrate. And within this window, it's possible to see that there is a distinct absorption spectrum of both oxygenated and deoxygenated hemoglobin, that is to say, the hemoglobin molecule without bound oxygen. So the opportunity to sort of interrogate hemoglobin is very useful because hemoglobin is, in some sense, a reporter of tissue oxygenation, and this is a central physiological parameter for understanding both cancer and also function in the nervous system, as we'll see in a little while. So, new contrast mechanisms, absorption, scattering, fluorescence, and others offer opportunities. Sensitivity to physiology and metabolism, that's what I was referring to earlier. Tissue oxygenation, etc. And then finally, perhaps most importantly these days, there is better living through chemistry. And what I mean by that is that it's possible to make designer molecules which have a fluorophore or some other sort of optically active component linked to some kind of biologically active component, such as a peptide of one sort or another that might bind to a particular receptor that has a well-defined biological activity. And so it's possible to map out the activity of such receptors, their density, by doing optical tomography. Okay, so I've shown here an example of such a molecule. It's known as indocyanine green. It's already approved for human use and has been in use for decades as a method for measuring liver function because it's primarily metabolized in the liver. But it has also been used by ophthalmologists to do angiography in the back of the eye. So this molecule is very convenient. It has a number of handles on it. Its chemistry is very simple and well understood, and one can derivatize it and make a number of different kinds of molecular contrast agents to do molecular imaging. So those are, in some sense, the reasons that people might be interested in optical tomography. Now, I'd like to turn to, in some sense, the physical basis for optical tomography. So in very, very broad terms, what we're really talking about is imaging in an opaque medium. And so there are two sort of extreme limits to think about. One is a medium in which there is virtually no scattering of light, but there is absorption. The other limit is one in which there's relatively little absorption, but a lot of scattering. And of course, what we deal with in practice is something in between, where both are important. So let's first of all consider the absorbing medium, and consider a very simple experiment in which we have a slab of material which is transparent, and in which there is an inclusion which is absorbing. So this is a glass of water and a little marble or something like that. So if we illuminate this slab with a plane wave, then what we see is a simple projection image of the interior of the slab. And in fact, if this were a well-collimated beam, then we would in fact discover that the intensity of light which is transmitted through the medium is given by the usual Beer's absorption law, which tells us that the attenuation of light occurs exponentially with the path length. And if we were to look at a number of different rays which pass through the slab, then we can just do standard tomography and reconstruct the interior of the medium. So in this sense, without scattering, we can do something which is very, very much reminiscent of X-ray CT. Fortunately, tissue is very scattering, and so this idea breaks down. So now let's consider the opposite limit, in which we have a lot of scattering. So now we have a medium which looks like a glass of milk, so we can't really see through it. It's white. Many, many suspended particles. And if we do this experiment again, what we find out is that we no longer see a nice projection image of the blob inside, but if the radiation is coherent, in fact, we see a speckle pattern, and it's not at all obvious how the structure of the medium is embedded in that pattern. So one very simple and heuristic way to understand this is to say that, well, if you think about the path of a single photon, you can think of it as a bit like a random walk, where the step size of this random walk is known as the transport mean free path. Transport mean free path, you can think of as essentially the average distance a photon has to go before its direction gets randomized. And so in tissue, where the scatterers are relatively large compared to the wavelength, or of the order of the wavelength, the light is predominantly forward scattered, and there are many, many scattering events which take place before the direction gets randomized. So at about 800 nanometers, the relevant length scale L star is about a millimeter in tissue. Okay, and we're in the multiple scattering regime because the overall size of the tissue we're interested in is much greater than L star. And L star, again, is large compared to the wavelength of light. And so, in some sense, we can neglect the interference between paths of single photons. And so a very simple classical picture suffices. There are more sophisticated ways of trying to understand this, but I think for our purposes today, this is okay. And Arnold Kim, in his talk on transport equation, will present an alternative viewpoint. Okay, so how do we image in a scattering medium? So maybe the simplest way to start to think about this, which was popularized about 10 years or more ago, was to consider an experiment in which we have an ultra-fast laser, which produces a very nice sharp pulse, which is then detected at some distance away. And then the time resolved intensity is plotted as shown over here. So at very, very short times, then, of course, the photons which emerge at the detector are relatively unscattered. They appear over here. And so in a sense, one can filter out the effects of scattering by gating in time. And these so-called ballistic photons, which are not, of course, really ballistic, have what one might think of as relatively good and undistorted information about the interior of the object. Unfortunately, those ballistic photons are exponentially attenuated, and they are attenuated on a scale which is basically given by L star. So in a medium which is optically thick, the number of such photons is very, very small, and one would have to have an exponential increase in laser power in order to do this, and of course it's unacceptable. So what comes out at later times? What comes out at longer times, here for example, are the multiply scattered photons, the diffused photons. And so the question, of course, we're really going to be interested in is, can one use the information contained in that signal at somewhat longer times to make reconstructions? Now, obviously, the answer must be yes, or I wouldn't be here. Okay. So let's try to be a bit more precise about the nature of the diffuse light. So on scales which are large compared to L star, one can think of the random walk process as really a diffusion process, and so therefore there's a diffusion equation, and what obeys the diffusion equation is the energy density of the diffuse wave. And so I've written a very standard diffusion equation here, and we'll, for simplicity in this talk, consider the situation in which the diffusion coefficient is really constant, does not vary from point to point in space, but the absorption of the medium does. The more general situation, of course, can be readily handled, but I would like to not do that today. I'll also focus on the source term in this equation, and there are two types of sources that we'll be interested in. One is the pulsed case, in which case it's physically more sensible to think about paths, or photon paths in a certain sense, and the other possibility is a modulated source, in which case it'll, as we'll see, it will become more sensible to think about the transport of light as being described by a kind of a wave. Okay, so we have a differential equation. We also need some boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions that we'll be interested in are mixed boundary conditions, also known as, I think, Robin boundary conditions on the surface of the medium. And there's a free parameter in this which tunes between a completely absorbing or black boundary and a completely reflecting boundary. And once that boundary condition is specified, then it's possible to relate the intensity, which is measured at a detector, directly to the energy density, which obeys the diffusion equation. And so we have a way to actually understand experiments. Todd, can you let me know when I have about 10 minutes? Thanks. Okay. So let's think about the very simplest possible case. And we'll work from now on exclusively in the frequency domain. So we will have an amplitude modulated source. And of course, everything is linear here. So that means the light which comes out is also modulated at the same frequency as the light that went in. So there is an AC part, the oscillatory part, as well as a DC part. And from now on, we will also focus only on the DC part, and we can do this by simple phase-sensitive detection. Okay? So in an infinite medium, if we have a point source of such light, we find that the oscillatory part of the diffusing wave looks something like a spherical wave. That is to say, it travels outward radially from the source, but rather than simply propagating in a simple way, it both propagates and decays. And the wave number, which describes this propagation, so to speak, is determined, of course, by the absorption of the medium, its diffusion coefficient, and the modulation frequency. And the key point to understand is that this sort of non-propagating spherical wave or diffuse wave has a wavelength and a decay length which are approximately the same. And so what that means is you can't go very far from the source and still measure the wave. Okay? So this is intrinsically a near-field kind of phenomenon. And that concept has a lot of important implications for the resolution of experiments. So just to be very, very concrete about this, if you take a typical biological system and you look at the numbers, you modulate at a reasonable rate, which is a couple hundred megahertz, the diffuse wavelength is of the order of 5 to 10 centimeters, which is the size of the sample that you want the image to begin with. Okay. And so maybe it's worth spending a little bit more time on these diffuse waves. They're really not all that unfamiliar, I think, to this group. Analogs of them arise in other physical situations. For example, in quantum mechanics, if we have a one-dimensional barrier and the potential energy is above the energy of the incoming a particle, then of course the wave function decays exponentially inside of the barrier. And this is very much like the situation I described. Another analogous situation would be the scattering of an electromagnetic wave off of a metal. And again, here, the electric field inside of the metal decays and propagates roughly on the same scale. This is a so-called evanescent wave. And Scott Carney, in his talk today, will mention a number of connections between tomography with evanescent waves and diffusion tomography.
There is another example. Shear wave in viscous liquid.
Yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah. I agree, because of the damping.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you. Okay.
I like shear wave.
Yes. Okay. So let's now consider a somewhat more complicated situation. Suppose we have an experiment in which the optical absorption of the medium is inhomogeneous and varies from point to point. And we consider an experiment in which we have a point source and a point detector. And we ask, well, what is the what does the AC part of the diffusing wave do? Well, of course, as in standard scattering theory, there is an incident contribution from the source itself plus the scattered wave. And the scattered wave can be thought of as arising from a number of secondary sources which are placed on the inhomogeneity. These secondary sources then propagate by means of the Green's function, which we've already seen. It's this exponentially decaying spherical wave sort of thing. And one can write an analog of the Lippmann-Schwinger equation, which describes the situation. And you'll notice, of course, that there's a minus sign here, which tells you that the medium is absorbing and one should lose intensity as a result of that. So, of course, one can convert this integral equation into a scattering series, into a multiple scattering series, and there are terms of first order, which corresponds to a single scattering event of the diffuse light, right? And then higher order terms, which correspond to multiple scattering events, again, of the diffuse wave, not of the electromagnetic wave, which is underlying the phenomenon. Okay. So, for now, what I would like to do is consider the situation in which the fluctuations in the spatial fluctuations in the absorption of the medium are relatively small, in which case it's possible to linearize the Lippmann-Schwinger equation. And there are a number of ways that one can do this. The simplest would be the so-called Born approximation, but the Ritav approximation and others, mean field approximations of various sorts, can also be made. And these so-called renormalized perturbation expansions all have the same sort of form, and they are closely reminiscent, in a way, of the Radon transform that we saw before. So we have some sort of transmission coefficient, which obeys an exponential absorption law, but instead of integrating along lines, we integrate with respect to this kernel K here. And this kernel, of course, is computable within the Ritav approximation simply in terms of the Green's functions of the unperturbed medium. And at very, very large values of the wave number K, which corresponds to high absorption in the medium or high modulation frequency, when the path lengths are relatively cut off, you can see that this kernel is concentrated somewhat nicely along the line connecting the source and detector. But at smaller values of this wave number, in which there is less absorption and the longer path lengths are prevalent, this kernel spreads out a bit. And this, of course, is a situation we're interested in vivo. Okay. So we now come to the inverse problem. And so the inverse problem basically says the following. It says, suppose we have an inhomogeneous medium and we make measurements from a number of source detector pairs which are arranged on the boundary of the medium. Is it possible to reconstruct the absorption inside of the medium? And of course, there are extensions of this to the diffusion coefficient that I won't talk about today. And the key point to understand is that this is really, you know, a nonlinear ill-posed problem, and Simon will really tell us in full glory about how bad this can be. But today, what I would like to do is to concentrate, at least initially, on a linearization of this problem, and if we have time, I will talk about some extensions to the nonlinear case. Okay. So, as I mentioned then, what we really want to do is make a number of different measurements on the boundary of the medium and then solve this linear integral equation. And the simplest thing that one can do, of course, is a numerical method. And then I will talk about some analytic approaches to the inverse problem a bit later. So how do the numerical methods work? I really don't want to belabor this point very much. Everyone knows. You simply discretize the integral equation. You sample the absorption at a number of points at the interior of the medium. And then you solve the resultant set of algebraic equations. And one has to do this somewhat carefully to take into account the fact that the inverse problem is ill-posed, etc. Okay. So, let's give some idea of what can be achieved with this very, very simple approach to the linearization and numerical solution to the inverse problem. So this is a device that was built at Penn in Britton Chance's laboratory about 5 to 7 years ago. And it's a time domain diffusion tomography system. Of course, we have a pulse laser just as we had before. We have an optical switch to switch between the different fibers which are placed on either side of two compression plates, since the obvious application here is going to be to mammography. And then a number of detectors as well. And then some electronics to do the photon counting. And so this is a sort of a baby version of a more sophisticated system that Simon will talk about, the monster system. This only had something like 8 detectors and 16 sources when this was built at the time. Okay. So nevertheless, the first studies that were made with the device at Penn were optical mammography studies. And without going into a great deal of detail about the motivation for this, I think it's important to understand that conventional mammography, at least as we were taught as medical students, misses at least 15% of mammographically of confirmed tumors, right? So at least 15% of tumors are mammographically occult or x-ray invisible. In fact, the evidence from MR studies is now that number may be as high as 30%. Okay, so why is it that one might expect biologically to see a breast tumor within the near infrared part of the spectrum? So the answer goes back to hemoglobin, right? So one of the sort of concomitant things that occurs during the growth and progression of breast cancer is that tumors need new vessels, right? They have to eat. At some point, they get to be too big, and they lose their ability to get nutrients simply by diffusion, and they have to grow these vessels in a process called angiogenesis. And so what that leads to is an increase, a local increase in the total hemoglobin concentration within the tumor. There's a second concomitant of this, which is that tumors also tend to be hypermetabolic, right? They become hypoxic. They use a lot of oxygen. And so that changes the saturation of hemoglobin, that is to say the fraction of the total molecule which has oxygen bound to it. Okay? And so those two things can be addressed by making measurements at two wavelengths within the near-infrared spectrum. I think it's also very important to say at this point that this is essentially a research tool, and that its role in the diagnosis and management of patients with breast disease is completely unclear. Okay, so what I will talk about now are just a couple of anecdotal examples. Okay. So this is what ductal carcinoma looks like. Ductal carcinoma is the most common true cancer of the breast. And so this is a postmenopausal woman who has a mammographically occult tumor, that is to say one which is not visible by x-ray. And what you can see here is an absorption reconstruction at 780 nanometers. Here is one at 830 nanometers. And from these two measurements, one can compute the total hemoglobin concentration, which you can see is locally increased in the tumor, as well, if you sort of use your imagination, as the hemoglobin saturation, what you can see is decreased relative to the background normal breast parenchyma. And so this is the idea I was trying to...
Can you define better hemoglobin saturation?
Yes, it's the fraction of hemoglobin which has oxygen bound to it. So arterial hemoglobin saturation in you and me at the capillary level is about 100%. But of course, arterial saturation is about 100%, but at the capillary level, it's much lower. It's on the order of 70%. Okay. So this next slide shows a comparison between two patients, one with a ductal carcinoma that you saw before, and the other with a fibroadenoma, which is the most common benign tumor of the breast. And what you can see, if you sort of take these things at face value, is that their hemoglobin, total hemoglobin concentration is the same. You can't really distinguish these two lesions by this method alone.
This is the slap joint.
Yes.
So this is which depth?
Yeah, somewhere in the middle of the slab. And in fact, it's a good question, because we don't have very many source detector pairs, and it turns out that this apparatus was built in such a way to be compatible with an MR scanner. And so we actually knew the depth of the tumor and used that information in this reconstruction. So the reconstruction was essentially that of an effectively two-dimensional volume within the three-dimensional volume. Okay? So now, in work that was done by Vasilis Natsikristos when he was a graduate student at Penn, we look at the contrast enhancement in the same two patients after they have been given an intravenous injection of indocyanine in green. So this is, of course, an off-label use, but this medicine is very, very safe, and we received IRB approval at Penn to do this experiment. And what you see is that there is a really nice enhancement of the ductal carcinoma compared to the fibroadenoma. Right? And this has to do with the fact that the vascular endothelium in the carcinoma is much leakier, at least this is what we think, than the corresponding endothelium in the benign tumor. And so there is an accumulation of contrast agent inside, which can then be imaged. And of course, the hope would be to do something which was a bit more sophisticated by derivatizing those molecules and then going after particular receptors on the cell surface, but this at least sort of gives some indication of what can be done. Okay, so it's been amateur hour until now. Let's see what the professionals have done. So the people at Philips, Martin van der Mark and colleagues, built an optical mammography scanner about 5 years ago that, unlike the one I showed you from Penn or the one that Simon will talk about, is a simple CW system. So the laser diodes are on essentially continuously, and instead of having a very large number of expensive detectors, they used a very large number of very inexpensive photodiodes. And with this trade-off, it was possible to build a system that had 256 sources, which could be individually switched by optical fibers at a number of different wavelengths, and 256 detectors, all of which could be read out simultaneously. And so this is a much larger data set. So they were able to do some truly 3D reconstructions using essentially the same method that I showed you before. And here's an example from that work. And what you can see is that there is a tumor over here in the right breast. And you can visualize it in three different cuts, which are standard mammographic cuts. But you can also see that the resolution is quite crude. Nevertheless, there were some interesting conclusions, I think, from the Philips work. So they studied, as far as I know, the largest series of patients that anyone has looked at so far. That's 300 patients in a clinic in Amsterdam. They looked only at intrinsic contrast, that is to say, they didn't use indocyanine green or any of its cousins. And they have some numbers that I know about, and I'm sure that there has been a more complete analysis of data since I last spoke to Martin. But what they think is that they were able to detect something like 70% of tumors that were greater than a centimeter in size. A centimeter is an important number clinically, because that typically is the size of a tumor that you can palpate, even if it's relatively deep. I think the most interesting and exciting thing that they discovered was that there were 5 mammographically occult tumors within this population, and they saw 4 of them. Okay. However, carcinoma in situ, that is to say very, very small lesions which have not yet progressed to full cancers in a certain sense, we don't know anything about it, and we're presumably not very readily detectable. And this is because, in part, the resolution of the device is quite crude, and also because carcinoma in situ probably does not lead to derangements of the microvascular circulation. That is to say, no angiogenesis. So sensitivity and specificity in this method is not known yet. Okay. So now, you know, there's some I think relatively fundamental questions that one can ask after looking at the situation to this point. And they relate to things like, well, what's the real resolution that can be achievable in a system like this? How does it scale with the number of source detector pairs that are available? How does the computational complexity of the algorithms that we deal with let us take advantage of the possibility of making very large arrays of data, which I'll talk about in a moment? So this is a question I've been interested in for some time and have done quite a lot of work on with my colleagues at Washington University when I was there, and that I'm now continuing to focus on now that I moved back to Penn. And the approach is really the following. We try to find some very simple mathematical situations in which we can try to be as explicit as possible about the solution to the inverse problem. And yet we hope that those situations are still clinically important. And so we're thinking largely about mammography. So this is a very restricted class of problems compared to the set of problems that Simon will talk about, which have very complicated boundaries and to which our methods are really not applicable. So what we really want to emphasize here then are the construction of inversion formulas, and to say explicit solutions, both to the linear inverse problem and, if we have a little bit of time, to the nonlinear inverse problem. And again, I want to emphasize that very large data sets are not at all difficult to imagine. In fact, if you forget about optical fibers and make a non-contact system involving essentially an electromechanical mirror galvanometer to scan the beam and a CCD camera and a nice lens, then one can accumulate vast numbers of measurements. And the question is what to do with them. Is it useful? How many is enough? Etc. So devices like this are being currently built at Penn. Okay. So again, to be explicit, what we really want is an inversion formula for this linear integral equation and eventually for some nonlinear extensions of it. And by that we mean some new kernel K such that if we integrate it on the surfaces of the medium in which the sources and detectors are present, and we integrate it against the data, that we recover the optical properties of the medium explicitly. And the cases in which it's possible to do this are few and far between, and they always involve situations in which there's a lot of symmetry. So, for example, if the sources and detectors are arranged on a plane, or on two planes, so parallel plates. And of course, cylinders and spheres are also possible, and I will focus today mainly on the biplanar case. So I don't want to say a lot about this because it's technical and there's not a great deal of time left, but suffice it to say that within those situations, it's possible to analytically construct the singular value decomposition 10. Thank you. I think I'm okay. The singular value decomposition of this forward scattering operator K. And this decomposition essentially has modes which look like plane waves in the transverse direction, right? And that's associated, of course, with the direction of symmetry. And in the longitudinal direction in which symmetry is broken, the structure of these modes is a bit more complicated. They look essentially like decaying exponentials or linear combinations of such things, and they can be worked out explicitly in a number of cases. I can talk more about that later on if necessary, but the key point is that once you have the singular value decomposition, of course you can work out the singular value decomposition of the pseudo-inverse, which then needs to be appropriately regularized, and you can then use this to do reconstructions. Just a few points to be made. Of course, this is a singular value decomposition in a Hilbert space setting. This is not a numerical procedure per se. And it gives you, of course, the unique minimum norm solution to this inverse problem, independent of other questions of a uniqueness in existence that can be discussed. Another important point to understand is that this inverse problem is overdetermined, right? We have, in some sense, 4 degrees of freedom in the data and 3 degrees of freedom in the thing that we want to reconstruct. And this is very useful because, in a way, it allows us to average out some of the instability numerically. And another key point is that the computational complexity of this procedure is quite good. It scales as essentially n log n, where n is the number of measurements, and this should be compared to a typical n cubed scaling for a simple algebraic procedure. So the implication, of course, is that we can go to very, very large data sets if that were to make sense. The inverse problem is ill-posed, of course, and so this limits the number that we can go to in some way. Okay, so that's the first thing to understand. The second thing to understand is that it's possible to analyze the effects of sampling in limited data. So rather than thinking about the sources and detectors as occupying a continuum of positions on the surface, one can sample, let's say, on a lattice. Of course, that makes the problem underdetermined. And so the best thing that we can do within the singular value decomposition formulation of the problem is to find the best, in an L2 sense, band-limited approximation, transversely band-limited approximation, to the absorption. Okay? And so let me talk about how that works then in a simple situation. So here we have, let me try to focus that a little bit better. Yeah, good. So here we have a simulation, which I think is relatively realistic, of an optical mammography experiment with a single point absorber in the mid-plane of a slab. So it's about, let's say, a 6 centimeter thick or 8 centimeter thick slab. and what we've adjusted here is the spatial sampling frequency at which the detectors and sources are arranged, as well as the window, the size of the window on which the data is taken. And what you can see over here, when we have something like 32 sources and 32 detectors, is a rather big blob, but as the size of the window and the spatial frequency increase, this narrows down quite a lot and comes down to a size of about full width half maximum L star or so. Okay? So this is almost inverse crime, but there is noise added to this simulation. And the key point to understand here is that we're looking at the transverse resolution in the mid-plane of the slab. Of course, this is the worst possible case. But there is also resolution out of plane, and that's where the problems start. So I should say, by the way, before I finish, that there are something like 10 to the fourth sources and 10 to the fourth detectors in that simulation. And so therefore, that reconstruction would be, as far as I can tell, impossible to imagine carrying out by any other means than this inversion formula with current computers. Okay, so let's take a look now at the out-of-plane resolution. So this is a situation in which we have essentially simulated the Philips system or something like it. There are roughly 400 sources and 400 detectors. This is the mid-plane. And here we have a relatively small window, and you can see that there is not very good localization of the absorber in the plane, and it occurs in deeper and deeper slices. But as the window size increases, the localization becomes a bit better until the window size is infinitely large, in which case, and there is no noise present, in which case the problem is still ill-posed, and the reconstruction is not ideal, and this is simply a reflection of the intrinsic instability, numerical instability of this whole business. Okay. What about extended objects? So here, instead of a single point absorber, we have a relatively large sphere, something like 6 centimeter diameter within this 8 centimeter diameter slab, or sized slab. And we adjust the contrast of this sphere to vary from roughly 1% to about 20% to 35% to 50%. And what you see in these reconstructions is that when the contrast is small and the problem is very linear, that the reconstruction works well. But as the contrast increases, that the reconstruction begins to break down. And what you see is the outer shell of the sphere, but not the interior. In some sense, the light doesn't really penetrate very well, and it becomes impossible to make a good reconstruction. So this requires the use of nonlinear methods, and I'm not going to have a lot of time to talk about that, but Simon will. How much time do I have, Todd? Am I almost done? Or
5 minutes.
5 minutes, great. Okay. But the main point that I want to make here, and I'll be happy to discuss this with later, is that it is possible to also, in some sense, systematically correct and to introduce nonlinear corrections to the linear inversion formulas. And this is a story for another talk. But one can do this to arbitrary order, in some sense. And of course, there is increasing computational price to pay at each order of this correction. I won't talk about it, but I will show some results. We have a paper on this, which came out in the May issue of the Journal of the Optical Society of America. And what you can see here by looking at the first nonlinear correction is that the interior of the sphere begins to fill in. And this can be seen somewhat more quantitatively by looking at some cross sections. So here we have a situation in which we have something like 35% contrast. Here we have somewhat less contrast, 20% or so. The green reconstruction shows the linear reconstruction, and the red shows the first nonlinear correction. And you can see that there's some improvement. And presumably, if we work to higher order, the situation will improve, although we don't know yet how much. I think that it's also possible, but not enough time, to really explain that there's a way to understand this nonlinear inverse scattering series that I've alluded to and to relate it to Newton-type methods. And in fact, one can prove that in the limit in which this procedure is carried out, that one recovers a solution which is equivalent to the so-called Newton-Kantorovich method. One can also prove that the resolution of the nonlinear problem to any finite order in this series is controlled by the resolution of the linear problem. Okay. So I think maybe that's a good place to stop. I'd like to, of course, acknowledge a lot of people who were both at Penn and at Washington University. Primarily, of course, at Penn, I'd like to mention Britton Chance, who did the experimental work that I mentioned, and also one of our graduate students, Masaru Ishii, and at Washington University, a very talented postdoctoral fellow, Vadim Markel, who's now going to be joining the faculty at Penn, and of course my colleague Jody O'Sullivan, who contributed to the work on the nonlinear reconstructions, and our funding agencies, NIH, NSF, and the Air Force. Thanks very much.
The technique you used, use the diffusive wave.
Yes.
And how do you choose the modulation, the frequency modulation?
Yeah.
And did the wavelength you have, how it is compared to the transport mean free path?
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so the choice of the modulation frequency is essentially the reciprocal. It's typically the reciprocal of the transit time if one were to do a pulsed experiment. So that's on the order of a nanosecond, and so that's where you get those numbers. So that's about a gigahertz. And
okay.
Right. L star here is taken to be about a millimeter, and the sizes of the tissue are, of course, 100 L star. Yeah. Simon?
You mentioned about the four-dimensional data and the three-dimensional reconstruction and making it overdetermined. So it just occurred to me you could take the sources on a line in the detectors on a client or something analogous. In other words, you could take a three-dimensional subset.
Yeah, it's
and it. Maybe you could construct something equivalent to Toy's condition of cone beam reconstruction for the unique.
That's an interesting suggestion. We looked at a problem in which we had a single source and a single detector, but in order to break the symmetry about the midplane, we added a couple of extra detectors. So we called those detectors were very close to the axis. We called this a paraxial geometry. Of course, there are only 2 degrees of freedom in that system because if they're yoked together and they scan, the problem becomes underdetermined. But then we make use of, in quotes, frequency diversity, and so we sweep the frequency as well. Now we have 3 additional degrees of freedom, and in that case, the problem is invertible, and one can work out the inversion formulas in this situation, as well as the nonlinear corrections. And we have a paper on that which appeared about a year ago in Optics Letters. So it was about last summer, I think. So yeah, that's a good question, but your comment I will try to think about.
You showed reconstruction correlations that range from, say, 1% to 35% in contrast.
Yeah.
What's kind of the range that you would expect of lesions that you could see in
correlation? Yeah, that's a good question. So we think, but we don't really know, that the contrast at, say, 800 nanometers for a breast tumor is about a factor of 2. But that's in a relatively small lesion. These were very large spheres. And so, of course, even if the contrast is small, the Born approximation would break down anyway. And so that's what we're really trying to show.
John, just to clarify your question, you say frequency versus frequency of the modulation.
So what I mean, if I understand you correctly, what I mean is the modulation frequency. Yep. Okay.
So we need your help. We need to get this to work.